bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hello!
And that's it! That's it. All we got.
This is the normal cast of crew.
Get well soon to Brian and Bonnie. They announced last week that they have, unfortunately, they got COVID while trying to get a dog. So we will hear from Brian soon, but everybody go wish him well at Schwood on Twitter.
Yeah. So we'll get the details about that. We'll get to the real details about this new Modern Rogue video that they're probably working on.
Yeah.
Called Let's Get COVID. Kind of some cool news came out today. That is water on Mars. We've heard about this before, but some researchers said they've got proof. Last year, there was a paper that came out that said, hey, we think we found evidence of a lake underneath the ice cap on Mars. And this is a new paper that says, yes, we think we've got more confirmation of this. Actually, there might be like three lakes. Some of them as many as like, I got to pull up the data here, but I think like 30 to 50 kilometers across. So, I mean, that's pretty interesting. It's not confirmed. There are other people say we're not sure if we read into the data the same way, but it looks like there is a growing body of evidence that there might be bodies of water, not just ice, but actual liquid bodies of water underneath the ice and maybe other places on Mars.
So, wow. So this is really the biggest factor here is the idea of colonization, right? Or some kind of permanent settlement, because it would be easier if there is a natural water source. We can infer that there is the ability to not have to synthesize it there, right?
That's absolutely part of the impact, is the idea that the more water there is on Mars, the better our chances of being able to build, you know, a civilization on Mars, because water, as you know, is kind of critical. But also it brings up the possibility that could there still be life on Mars? Now, the problem with this water is that the salinity, we estimate the brininess, is extremely high, higher than anything on Earth where we've ever found life. We have places in Antarctica, we've had pools of water, but it's so salty that nothing lives there as far as we know. And that could be the same case here, which if there's no life, it makes it probably an easier case for colonizing. If we find that there's life there, then it's sort of like, hey, do we want to be, you know, how much impact do we want to have on this environment? But, you know, the chances of there being life there is probably not terribly high.
Yeah. Which, I mean, again, that is always one of the fascinating ideas, is that we'll progress to the point where we are indeed a multi-planet species and we're able to get there and we're like, oh, wait, also, let's figure out what we're going to do with all this life here now. Whoopsie. Yeah.
Well, and I don't think that will be an inconsequential, if there was that. I think that's the best case for, you want, life would show you that it's possible for life to exist. But, yeah. Or, you know, to colonize life, as we try to be more proactive about being concerned about our environment, you know, that creates another situation where, if, let's say, we found a wonderful underneath cavern, you know, cavern underneath the soil of Mars, but there was life in there, we might be hesitant to sort of want to live in there, because we might say, oh, you know, do we want to do that? So, you know, these will be real issues.
There was a new Mars probe or a rover that went up very recently, right? Is that right, Andrew?
There's going to be, we have a rover that we've sent up. There's like the Mars 2020. And I just want to address some of the comments says, oh, yeah, like Europeans worried about all the pre-existing life when they landed in America. It's true they didn't, but we're not them. You know, we were sending, when the people who were doing space exploration, NASA and space agents and stuff, worry considerably about this. You know, we've withheld rocket launches because of the wildlife impact on semi-threatened species. We've said, no, we are extremely cautionary now. Not to say that we always will be and that will be the norm, but I would say that we use an abundance of caution, because we look back at the past and go, oh, what impact did we have here? and we don't want to repeat those. You know, there are more people like you going, well, what about this, than there were back then? You know, there weren't a lot of people worried about, you know, it's like, that's not a novel thought now. Everybody's thinking this, like, well, morally, we made some bad choices in the past, perhaps, you know, what do we do going forward?
But my question about the rover is, are these machines that are going up, are they equipped to check for life? Are they equipped to look for water? Do we know that?
Yes, they have different tools that are designed to sort of look for life. Like the new rover we have actually has a drill that will drill into the surface and will actually be able to go deeper than we have before. We're using new kinds of, you know, radar and et cetera to sort of try to penetrate that. So we've increased the tools that go on the rovers to be able to look for life, you know, and it, if it's miles beneath or it's deep in caverns, we're a lot likely to find evidence of that. But if we are able to find stuff in the surface and signs of stuff, you know, you might be looking for gas traces, things like that, that could give you an indication there could be something going on there.
Okay. So let's say we do find, through a mix of like rovers and samples and testing, that you can generate water on Mars, or that there is a mechanism through which water can be generated on Mars. What does that mean, broadly speaking, for, I don't know, human trips out there?
So it depends. If we go into, one of the things they'll do is they'll take a sample, you get like a dirt sample, and they put it into basically an oven, and they heat it up, and you see what comes out of it. And if you find that we're able to go towards areas that maybe have high moisture content or have presence of water in there, it gives you an idea of how much water would be available. And that can give you an idea of how much energy it would take, because in order to extract water from the soil, you would need to have, you know, apply energy to it to be able to do that. So right now we could probably get sort of a thumbnail sketch idea of what that might entail. But later missions, and SpaceX is, you know, looking into this considerably, because if they're going to be refueling their rockets on Mars, you know, they need to be able to, you know, produce methane. And in order to do that, you're going to need to be able to have, you know, access to water because of the hydrogen and oxygen. And so we'll see what happens from, you know, what's going to be launched later on. Like at some point, there probably be some joint missions, probably ideally with them and NASA, to send some more sophisticated landers and stuff designed to see what you can do.
Do we know where, I assume we know whereabout we are going to land these landers. Are they close to where we would suspect that these ice caps are, or the lakes? Like, is this something where this is like part of the plan? I presume that like pretty much the entire life cycle of this lander is already planned out.
Yeah, they're not going to be, as far as I understand, anywhere near where, let's say, the ice caps are. But they're going to be in regions that look like they're pretty interesting to that. And so I'm looking here, the 2020 landing site, Jezero Crater. So if you go to, NASA has a website, you can go see where they have the landing site selection, and they show you where the finalists were. And they're all kind of in the middle latitudes. Where they could go from. So basically, you know, that was settled on that. So I think that was like, yeah, Jezero. So those are going to be towards the middle there. But those are places where they look for what's going to be the most interesting. And, you know, there's a whole list of science criteria. And so, for instance, criteria number one is the site is astrobiologically relevant, ancient environment, and has geological diversity that has potential to yield fundamental scientific discoveries. Basically, they were looking for places like, if there was evidence of life, would you find this there? And could it be things that may be ocean beds, et cetera, things like that. Criterion two, a rigorously documented and returnable cache of rocks and regolith samples that are near there. So can they get rocks and things like this for, you know, a return mission? And then three, and there's a high confidence assumptions evidence in any internal models to support the assessments or criteria at one and two. So criteria three is like one and two. It's kind of weird. Very corporate speak.
You have to see if there's so anyhow synergy, it kind of comes, if there's any collaboration sparks.
And so criterion five is the site has a high potential for significant water resources that may be of use for future exploration, whether in the form of water-rich hydrated minerals, ice or ice regolith, or subsurface ice. So that's saying, like, that's another criterion that weighs into that. First thing they want is, like, we want cool looking rocks. You know, we want cool looking rocks. If we find a place like that, and plus, we're able to find it near there within a distance of where the rover can go, we can also find things that look like there might be water, or ice, rather, then yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think that is a good thing to look forward to, and you can look forward to more and more Weird Things content when you support patreon.com/weirdthings. Keep this show a-rolling. Head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings, and get your custom RSS feed. That way, you just enter it in one time into the podcatcher of your choice. You don't have to sign in. You just get the After Things podcast sooner than anybody. Well, you get the After Things podcast full stop, and you get this episode probably sooner than you would otherwise. So head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings.
So there's an interesting study that came out, and it talks about they did a comprehensive survey of the cognitive and physical functions of elderly people and compared them to how people scored in the past. And so my question is that how would you say a cohort of, let's say, 70-year-olds scored today versus people from 1980s, 1940s, et cetera?
70-year-olds from those periods?
75 to 80. We'll put 75 to 80. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah. Not the same people. Gotcha.
No.
Yeah. I would presume that they would score better. That now, as life expectancy, although that's pretty much topping out at life expectancy, right? Life expectancy is around 85, 86, something like that. So 75 to 80, you know, you're coming up on what we know as the average there. So I would say, you know, I say better. They're sharper now than they were in the past.
I feel like I would say the opposite, only because I think we have so much more information at our fingertips. I feel like we tend to offload more information because it's so easy to say search for it. But then again, like I would say maybe the 70-year-old cohort today is still not super technically, tech involved. But I would say a future trend might be to trend down because we are so willing to offload information.
Oh, Bryce, you and you, this is the whole original sin. Every generation believes that the thing that they did made them worse than the generation before. All those people are like, well, yeah, everything was great before the radio came in, and everything was amazing before the television rotted our brains. And
those Nazi-era teens, like, yeah, everything's great before rampant anti-Semitism, you know, geez.
Yeah.
Justin's like, every generation says that.
Every generation they have their own thing. So, all right. Yeah, every once in a while, the Nazis prove you right. But, like, in general, the trend is that this stuff is things that we can survive.
Yeah. So they went and they did a comparison. They said among men and women between the ages of 75 and 80, muscle strength, walking speed, reaction speed, verbal fluency, reasoning, and working memory are nowadays significantly better than they were in people at the same age born earlier. In lung function, same. No change in lung function. But across the board, they find that, old people are getting younger.
And I would say part of that is the idea, our fundamental concept of exercise from at every level has kind of really, really, really changed from the, like, 50s and 60s. Like, the idea of everybody should get up and walk and everybody should do a thing and everybody should be a little bit more active, I think is fundamentally more pervasive. So it does not shock me to see that as people get older, they, you know, these old vessels are just in a little bit better shape.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, like exercising, like you keep stretching life expectancy out, you're going to see less fragility as people age. Yeah.
Yeah. Fibble says less smoking. Although I don't know if you're really going to see that necessarily with the people that are 75 and 80 now. I mean, they all lived through pretty heavy smoking you know, a publicly available smoking areas. Although certainly for you know, people my age, even, it's like I remember a kid. I remember as a kid there being a smoking section on airplanes, and then that like going away by the time that I was able to get on a plane by myself. So like there certainly were definitely different, even if you right away, whatever secondhand smoking is, just the permissiveness of smoking certainly has changed a lot for people my age.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of good news in the idea that, you know, we talk a lot about increasing lifespan, but quality of life is equally or more important, because, you know, to live to be an old age but to not be active may not be that fun. Versus here, where if your 70s and 80s are a lot like, you know, people in their 50s and 60s were a few decades ago, then that's meaningful. And, you know, we've seen seen some interviews with, you know, some, you talk to some people who are in their 100 years old, you know, yeah. And I've seen very articulate, interesting interviews with people. You go, you just keep going like, wait, this person's 100? Like they're 100? You know, because, you know, when I was a kid, I can remember sometimes talking to people at 70 and they were just shaky and unsteady, et cetera. And again, everybody, genetics plays a big factor in that. And we've seen, you know, you see that with people, you know, of an age certain now, you know, some people, you know, 75 sharp with their wits, some people not, whatever. And there's a lot of other components there. But overall, it seems to be a very good trend, the idea that, you know, that we're not. And I think anecdotally, I've seen this, like, my parents, you know, cogent and healthy so far, and knock on wood, and having conversations with them is different than I remember my grandparents when my grandparents were 10 to 15 years younger than them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we'll see. So hopefully trend that continues.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that is even on display, considering the fact that, like, we're looking at a presidential election where both candidates were at an age where previously we would not think that that would be a liability. The idea of candidates that are this old would be looked at as, all right, well, you're past your prime. America will reject the idea that you are this close to the life expectancy. But at the same time, now they're cogent enough, and their brand is so well established because they have had so much time in the public eye that it's a help. Now the name recognition outweighs the negative concept of it. So I think you can even look at real world examples of how different we treat what your 70s are. Before, yeah, it was just kind of putting you out to pasture.
So something that's been brought up here is, like, one of the reasons they account for this might be, you know, better nutrition or higher, you know, more access to nutrition. We certainly have a problem with, like, the body weights of elderly people are greater than they were before. Mm-hmm. And obesity is something that might be a bigger problem middle life towards later, but later on in life, as your body just starts not clinging to calories the same way, it may be a thing where it's not as much of a disadvantage obesity probably would be, but being sort of on the heavier side. Somebody brought up here, said, hey, I'd rather eat what I want than add a few extra years to my life. It's a great thought, but that's not the way it works, because it's like, I'd rather eat what I want, but then it's not that all of a sudden you add 5 years. It's the last 15 years aren't spent with diabetes. You know, that's the problem, is that it's not that, like, if I have the Snickers bar, I'll just take 6 months off your life. No, it just means the last part of your life, you're not going to be as healthy as you would have been. And that's what sucks, you know, is when you see people who are, they're not dead, they're alive, but they're taking a bunch of pills and medicating because maybe it was their food choices, maybe it's genetics, whatever, but it's not as easy as just, it's like, the cigarette takes a couple of weeks off my life. So what? It's like,
that's how they pushed it into us with cigarettes as a kid. It's like, a cigarette takes 6 hours off of your life. It's, you know, it's hard not to have that idea permeate into other unhealthy.
I know, habits. I agree. But it's like, it makes you have to walk around with an oxygen cylinder for the last 6 years of your life. You know? So it's the difference there. So, and again, genetics is crazy too. But for this case here, I think it's a combination probably of diet and, you know, geriatrics. We understand a lot more. You know, we know a lot more about, you know, and I would argue, Bryce, that internet and things like that have helped older people keep more alert, keep more active. You know, when you get older and you're not working and maybe your kids have moved on, you get less interaction. And you think of the idea of the old person sitting in the senior citizen home, you know, watching TV. That's not healthy. That's not fun. But if they're actively engaging, reading news, doing things like this and thinking about things and then, you know, yelling on Twitter, they're being active. And that's a thing that I think is that the we, you know, we're this period where all we want to do is think about the negative aspects of social media and this. And I'm going to argue that I would say 90% of the problem is the way we as individuals choose to see things and interact with things.
Oh, shut up, idiot.
Okay, I stand corrected. And I would say that we forget that, you know, we live in an information sphere where, you know, an 8-year-old and a 17-year-old can argue over things and they've never met before. You know, we don't know how to argue yet, and it's still problematic, but that conversation never existed before. It never happened before. And all of this is so new to us, and it's and we're aware of all of the down points to it, but we have to step back and say, like, I have several friends who are visually impaired because of the assistive technologies in the iPhone and because of the existence of the internet. Their function in the world has nothing to do with how sighted they are, you know, and that's kind of an amazing thing to think about.
Yeah, I would love to see some kind of, I'm sure there's scientific research about it, but if you just think to mirror, you know, my upbringing was radically different when I realized that I could have social interactions beyond my school friends and my family, the people that I was physically around, that I could find an internet message board that was talking about exactly what I wanted to talk about. And I could engage in that culture in a very visceral way. And it made my life better. I could only imagine that, especially compared to the alternative of you know, what happens in a senior citizen's home or what happens as you slowly, you know, have a loved one pass away and the thing that, like, but for example, my grandma passed on very shortly after my grandpa did because she lived her life with him. Like her world was wrapped around from when she woke up to when she went to sleep about that. Now, do I think that she would ever stop missing my grandfather if she had an online life to plug into? Like, no, of course she would have. She would have had to readjust it. But, like, would having a community and a hobby to pour herself into have been beneficial? 150%. And I think that that is something that we should look at in a very real way as a massive benefit. And just even from my perspective of, like, well, look, if it worked for me as an adolescent, then I'm sure it'll work for me when I'm 70 and nobody cares about my opinion, but I can still yell on Facebook.
Yeah. I like our comment here. My grandma went through 4 more grandpas before passing on.
Say what? Your grandma had a work ethic for which Viola Anzalone did not.
So on the subject of, like, the future of ways of which we interact, we've talked a lot about VR. And I saw this come up, and I thought it was cool. I thought, like, great, this is a cool first step. This is not the product I want, but I want, you know, the third generation of this. And this company called Ecto VR, EKTO VR, has these robotic boots. And I think we actually talked about a solution like this. I think on just an episode a few weeks ago, I brought up the idea of using robotics or something to sort of move underneath you instead of using the treadmill. And what this is basically you put these boots on and you walk in place. As you start walking, they slide backwards and you sort of kind of do this sort of moonwalk. So it feels like you are, you know, are, I don't know what it really feels like. These things look very big and very heavy. And you look at the person as they're walking, like they're trying to kind of not bump into
their feet. They look like moon boots in the Saw universe. They look like Jake Face put you into these. Would you like to play a game? And
yeah.
Your feet get trapped in these things.
No, yeah, you just, like, they do look like some Abercrombie model is going to be panicked when they realize their feet are locked into them.
Yeah. But I think that, again, I think they actually may be selling these. I'd be curious to see what the real world, you watch the person walking with this and it looks like they got something heavy on their feet, and I don't know how naturally that's going to feel like locomotion, but I could certainly see at a certain point solutions like this.
You are taking smaller steps because you're not stationary, but it's simulating you doing more with your foot and leg motion to make it to give you more mobility in game.
Well, if you pull up, yeah, there's video of this where you can watch them. Like VentureBeat has a video, and if you take a look at the thing in motion, you can see what it looks like as a person walks with them. And the idea is that working with, like, they have somebody playing Half-Life, you know, Alex, which, sorry that Brian's not here for many reasons, but that too. But you can see this person is sort of, it's weird because you see the thing where they're walking in the dark and you feel like they're just sort of following the cameras, following them along. But you look at their feet.
Yeah. It's like those videos where the people with the roller skates and they're kind of walking in place, but it's like motorizing him back. Wow.
Yeah, and if you kind of squint, it looks like the camera's tracking this person as they walk, but actually they're being kept in place. But if you look at their feet, it looks like they're lifting heavy things on their feet. You know, so I don't know. Never tried it.
That's interesting. So yeah, so it does. It's not like it's simulating the leg motion. You are walking. It's just slowly moving you back to the center, either in the walk or as your pause, but largely when you're walking, it is slowly just moving you. I wonder if when you're running, what the situation is there, but that's fascinating.
I would also be like, they have a pretty large space here in this test video that they're using. And so it's one of those things where, I don't know, you've seen the, what is it? The thing where you get like strapped into it and you start walking, but it's a slippery or it's a slick floor.
Like the treadmill approach. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the treadmill stuff. Like at least that has a set footprint, where this, like this still, they're still using a pretty large space. He's not moving too far out of the center there, but I also would like to see what this looks like if you have to kind of pick up the pace.
Well, I think for this, they should have probably put a grid on the ground or a box on the ground so we can get an idea, because it is hard to tell. But I mean, it looks like he's actually staying, because it's a small room. If you look at the size of the room, I will tell you this. It is deceptive because you watch him and you feel like he's traveled a distance. Then you look at his feet and you're like, no, he's exactly in the same spot.
Yeah, I actually think that the video that we're watching right now, he is walking in a fully black room, which I don't think does this experiment any favors, because it seems as if he's moving a lot more than he really is. I think functionally in this entire video, you would be shocked, Bryce, at how small the circle would be of where his feet actually fell.
Yeah, I that would be a thing I would like to see of this, is like, hey, we're using this wide angle lens, which makes rooms look bigger, but keep a look at, like, we've took all this video of all of his footfalls. He doesn't, go past these boundaries or anything. Interesting. He took like two small steps.
So part of this that I would say would be a little hard is that, like, when you are walking a lot, it is going to take the times where you are, where you're not moving to kind of move you back. And there's that moment at the very end where he's already taken a few steps and it's very kind of visibly sort of taking him, people mover style, like maybe an inch back or so. So I would wonder whether or not that's just something that either in the process it's stabilizing you, so you don't really even feel it. It looks a lot different than it would feel. And I wonder even how much your brain is just writing that off, because that's not what you're seeing. That's not what you're hearing. That's not where you're immersed in terms of the VR of it all. Because I wouldn't be shocked if that guy in that moment, who's supposed to be looking into this grate that he's pulled off, doesn't even realize that he just kind of moonwalked back an inch.
Yeah, I think they've got something really clever here, and I don't want to bag on it, but if you watch it and you look at, like, his feet, really feel like he's got like 10-pound weights attached to his feet. So, and maybe you don't pay attention to that, maybe you do. I've done underwater stuff with weights attached to my feet, and I can tell you, you're conscious of it. It does feel different, but I do think, you know, I'm excited to see more solutions like this. The treadmill thing, the problem with that is, like, the biggest problem most of my friends have with VR is finding a place to do VR. And it's not like most people have, oh, I have a VR room, you know, the 20 by 20 foot space where I'll just put the treadmill in the middle. Very few of my friends have that opportunity. And you need to think about solutions that, you know, can I put a yoga mat here? Great, I can do VR. And I think we need to be thinking more, how do you do it in a smaller space? So I think this is a great, you know, step, pardon the expression. And there's, you know, we've talked about the other ones of like using, you know, little robots that slide around under your feet and keep you moving. Really, you know, treadmills that you don't have to be strapped into that function kind of like an upside down Segway that sort of just know which way you're going, balance you out and keep you moving, et cetera. And there's a lot of potential solutions. We're in a great place with robotics and artificial intelligence right now that I think we're going to see some great solutions.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially for kind of a to be at a stage where it's like, hey, we can start to show this to the press and all. Like, that stuff gets miniaturized, that stuff gets lighter. I think that is a really cool idea, and I would love to see what people do with it, because you look at something simple just like Heelys, and how for a very long time those became various forms of viral trends, just doing things with Heelys. It would be fascinating to see what people do with this and what kind of things you can do when you expand VR, your VR space for everybody.
Yeah. It's funny, 'cause like I had a conversation with a friend of mine, like a week ago, 2 weeks ago. And I was talking about, remember the Segway skates? The Segway had like the wheels that go underneath your feet.
The hoverboards. Yeah.
Oh, no, yeah. Not the hoverboards.
Not the hoverboards.
No, these were ones, one under each foot. So if you look up, go to the Segway site.
Gotcha.
And do you see these things? I said, oh, these things are kind of cool, because I'm like, something like this for VR could be kind of cool. And if you go to, is that
this might be at the Segway Drift W1 e-skates.
Yeah. If you go to the website too, you can see those.
So these look like the one wheeled bikes that kind of are a thing now, but just little ones for each of your feet. That's kind of fun.
And you don't strap them in. You just stand on them.
You just stand on them. What? Oh, wow. And because they balance so well, you don't need to worry about it.
That's crazy. That's actually really cool.
Yeah, they actually, like, they came out with them, and actually, if you look up the Drifts, like, on Amazon, they started getting, like, you can get a pair for now for, like, $200, because nobody is buying them, as far as I know, and the problem was, like, I think they show the problem here, this guy, you can't go up a curve.
He can't go up, like, a little, it's not even, like, a hard corner curve, like, that was, like, a fire ramp curve, like, a driveway curb. I would not. Maybe it's safer, maybe it's smarter that you don't strap into these things, but I would not trust the, because I don't like hoverboards. I don't trust hoverboards either. And so I just look at this dude just standing on them, raw dogging it, and it couldn't be me.
Well,
and by the way, there was a moment in this video that we're watching where he got to not even a curb, but like just some mismatched a sidewalk, so there was a big lip, and I'm assuming the point of what he was saying is that he didn't even feel comfortable going over that, which is that's a problem for something like this.
Yeah, and that was you know, my friend Jordan, who tried these, we talked about that, because that was the biggest thing, was that like we just see this guy like a slight little sidewalk grade, and they're brilliant engineering, let me make this clear, brilliant engineering. You don't need to step, you just step on these things and move around. The problem was, this guy came across literally a sidewalk with a slight little little gradient on it, and pops off of it. And it's like, yeah, that there is no hopping on these things and making one trip all the way down Santa Monica Promenade without a problem. You know, and that's I'd say that's sort of the limitation there. I will show you though some other cool stuff. If you go to Segway site, again, Segway, did we talk about their they have a really cool concept here, or the device, the Lumo personal robot?
No, they make robots now?
Yep. Oh, Christ. They make, remember the little, they came out with the little Segway that sort of like the little hoverboard kind of thing that kind of came between your knees a bit. Kind of their version of the hoverboard. So go to the website, go look up consumer and look up the Lumo.
Sure, consumer.
And this is brilliant. This is actually a brilliant idea. And what it is, imagine a hoverboard with the middle of it that has a camera stalk, and it will follow you around. And when you're not using it, it can perform like a little robot that can do like, you know, be a, you know, go show up at a meeting for you or something too. So it's this transporter. So, you know, watching a video here of this thing, seeing, we're seeing the guy who's zipping around on his little mini transport, looking pretty cool, pops off the thing. And all of a sudden the thing, you know, they'll follow you. There's got like a camera and a display on it.
Oh, okay. So it's a hoverboard with a camera up your crotch. And it'll follow you.
Well, no, it's not looking up your crotch. But well, yes, the guy's walking 5 feet ahead of it as it follows him through the office. Then he hops onto it to start riding it around. And now a guy's, you know,
doing the robot and then talking to the robot.
Yeah.
So it is a camera, like a video camera. It is a personal robot assistant. And it is a hoverboard.
And it's like a dolly camera. Yeah. There's like camera functionality in here too. That's wild. Oh, and you can look through. It's a drone. It's of course it's a drone. It could. Whoa. This.
See, Brian could have been here for this right now.
He could. He would have bought two of these, I feel like. So, oh my, this is really cool. Okay. Wow. Is this like the. Is this the final form? Is this what kind of an all-in-one robot assistant device looks like? Like, is this the final form of this, I guess, is what I'm asking more?
I don't know, but when I saw it, I thought it was brilliant, the idea of combining, you know, the device with a personal robot, because I could see a thing where, you know, if you were in a situation where you wanted some form of transportation that was like, or you'd use a scooter or something else, but the idea that you could use this, hop into a store and it would follow you through the store, you know, or go wait for you or go come to you or, you know, perform little tasks. I think that, I don't know if this is the version of it, but I mean, pretty impressive. 30 mile range, you know, the idea that it can follow you when you need to be followed, etc. Very cool idea.
I will say, just to go down and get Postmates, that's worth it. Like that is worth it. Just to ride that, you have that go down and just put the order right there on the tray and have them roll back onto the elevator, come back up. Mwah, chef's kiss. I would love it.
That sounds a lot like those the robots that are on like school campuses now. You guys have surely seen stuff about these, right? It looks like this brand is called Starship, but they just. On like college campuses and stuff, they'll just have these little fools walking up and down the sidewalk delivering things.
Yeah. I could see like where I live, my apartment complex, I could see them building like a little robot door and just sending my robot out to go get my delivery from the sidewalk.
Yeah.
All right. Bryce.
Okay.
Do you know how much a Lumo costs?
I do not.
All right. So I'm going to let's go. Price is right. Style in this. Andrew, do you know?
I looked it up before.
Okay. All right. Here we go.
Justin, you know?
Bryce, how much is a Lumo?
Ooh.
Free shipping from Segway Official.
Okay. Got to take the shipping out.
Shipping right out.
So it's a Segway. It's like, it's a hoverboard. It doesn't have the handle, but it's a hoverboard. It's a camera. It's got it's got audio because you can hear it and you can make it speak. It's got like a screen and an app. Ooh, I'm going to say $3,500.
It's also programmable, Bryce. You can actually, you know, like you can create programs with drag and drop interface for it. It's your telepresence avatar.
Oh.
Bryce, if you've already carved out $3,400 out of your personal budget to buy a Lumo, do I got good news for you? Because you can have this Lumo, not for $3,400, not for $3,000, not even for $2,000. It can be yours today, Bryce, for $1,799.99.
Wow, that is insane. That is actually insane, I think, for all of the things that are in this, and then on top of it, like, the Segway branding. Like, if this was, like, this feels like a good Z-Yoon knockoff price. This doesn't even feel like a Segway. Wow, that's incredible.
I'm shocked I haven't seen any out in the wilds of the Bay Area, to be honest with you, because you see a lot of dumb tech stuff out here. But, like, that's actually, like, I don't know, maybe I should be paying attention to the people on those hoverboards more, because maybe they are rocking with those.
Well, and this is the next thing. Once all those hoverboards explode, they're going to get a new one. Well, and I got to get the nice one.
I mean, when you think about it, the concept of it really isn't all that radical, considering in a world where we're building in a personal assistant to every, where microwaves and clocks have voice assistants and stuff built in, like the idea of a hoverboard, which is already X amount of expensive, being able to have that sort of functionality. The question is really what the killer app is when it's meandering around with you. Like, what is, like, because, like, even that demo, there's a lot of cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure for if you are a programmer or something like that, you're like, oh, no, the platform is what I care about. I can program something that I really know and want, like, into it. But there's no consumer, like, oh, I got to get this for my non-tech savvy person in my life.
In the demo, they show a photographer, so he has a lot of opportunities to stop and get off and get the shot and then hop right on and do all the dolly zoom stuff. And then it, like, cuts to him, like, handing out posters for, like, his band or something. So
and he's, like, watching it from the other end of the park, like he's like a parent who's watching his kid try to sell, you know, Scout cookies or something like that.
Yeah, I could almost see, like, a courier system. Like, I could see an in-city big metro area, maybe like a courier doing short deliveries. But otherwise, I don't know.
I'll give you some thoughts on this. Like, my thoughts is, like, often it's like you had some engineers who came up with a really cool thing, and then some marketing people thinking, oh, what about this? What about this? Whenever they put, like, their problem about, hey, here's the SDK to do stuff, it means, like, they're waiting for the world to show them what to do with it.
Yeah.
My thoughts on this are, one is, I would love an attachment to, like, put that camera much higher. Like, yes. If you could put that 3 or 4 feet up. And I understand, too, with motion, you're going to get sort of, but there are ways to compensate for that, too. Like, I think having an attachment where the camera can go higher would be great. Like, you could go step in, like, you could have the camera extract. Think about guard mode at night or whatever, where you want the thing to just patrol your house. You hear a noise, go to the noise. The complaints have been tracking, and I've seen this, I think I told you before about a demo I went to in, like, downtown Burbank, where these people had this cooler that would follow you around. I'm like, oh, you know, what are you using for tracking? Bluetooth? Like, no, optical. I'm like, well, that'll be a problem. Like, no, it works great. And the woman goes to demonstrate it for me, and a guy walks right between her and the robot at that time, and it starts to follow the dude. And she's like, oh, hey, it's okay. I got confused. I'm like, yeah, because you're basically just locking onto, you know, it's they're, you know, and that's a thing that will improve. But that's improvable. Better algorithm for tracking and being able to follow would be great. But yeah, have an app where it's like, oh, this thing can go patrol your house at night. I don't know if you saw the Amazon indoor drone from Ring.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seemed interesting. I mean, an interesting idea. You hear a noise come into it, and then the clueless burglar who's frightened by a 6 ounce drone.
Yeah, I think that to me makes sense if you got, like, you know, a lake house or a rental property or something like that, and it's just like you want the peace of mind of being able to see it. Now you can. You can literally just do a walkthrough.
As a guy who had a townhouse that he was never at, 2,000 miles away, I totally see the value of something like the Ring drone. But with this thing, I could see attachments could be an interesting thing. Like, oh yeah, this thing will patrol your house while you're not there. That's kind of cool. I could see a thing that's like a pop-up sort of like I don't like grocery sort of hold your groceries, you know, while you shop kind of thing. You know, I could see the idea of creating some sort of like an accessories that do other cool functions could be valuable, and obviously probably iterating over the intelligence on it so it gets better at what it's supposed to do.
Yeah. I'm still so surprised by how cheap this device is and how much that sensing technology is going to get with the tracking, how much cheaper camera technology is going to get, that like maybe everyone has a do it themselves, or maybe they just put this technology into more things, right? Maybe you just go and your shopping cart does this for you. You stand in front of it and you wave at it and it follows you around the store, and it's scanning stuff as you put stuff in. I don't know. I could see both ways in terms of the miniaturization of this technology.
Yeah, we'll see. A lot of the stuff that it has, a lot of the technology in there is stuff that's kind of like, you know, the 3D sensing chips, things like this, or things that are commercially available. It's how you package it. And I don't know if Segway is going to be the one that's going to build a version that everybody wants. But I could see there is some version. Like, we all look at this and go, oh, this is cool, you know, because when it's not my hoverboard, it's a robot. And that's, you go, oh, okay, you know, that seems useful. I'll point to one more thing here. If you go onto the Segway site and you click on professional, or hover over professional, and then click on the Segway S-Pod.
Oh, now, just looking at the silhouette on the icon of the menu here, this definitely looks like the chairs from WALL-E.
Yep.
The seating... a seated Segway. So how does this work? Are you still balancing it? Are you moving it forward with your body weight? Are you programming it?
I don't know.
I think I remember.
It goes 25 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Wow.
Holy crap. That's 25 miles an hour at 330 pounds. That thing burns.
Oh, there's a video. S-Pod chair first ride review.
I think I do remember us talking about this, because this was like a CES thing, right?
I'll tell you what. A friend of the show, Darren Kitchen, when all the scooters were descending upon the Bay Area, was like into trying to buy his own version of the scooters. And he bought a couple. The one that goes the fastest gets up to about 25 miles an hour. And let me tell you, when you're on a scooter that's going 25 miles an hour, you are feeling the speed. Like it is something where you are keeping up with city traffic. That is a burner.
Yeah. Okay. So there's we've got someone doing a hands-on review. So he sits in it. Oh, I don't like this calibration. He sits on it, and it's like kind of leaned forward, and it's balancing, I guess. It's figuring out.
It's figuring out where you're leaning forward, so it knows what the triggers are. But I'll tell you what, that's easy though.
There's a little controller. There's a thumb controller. He's got his hand on a controller that's telling him.
Oh, he does. Okay, cool.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. Yeah, so we definitely did just watch him bump into his own camera. So, okay, yeah. if it's hand controlled. Oh, but he's texting in that shot. Wow.
They show Dr. Evil's chair later on.
Yeah.
is this okay? This is literally the WALL-E chair though at this point. What is this going to do to old people?
Can I tell you, like 20 years ago when Segway first got announced, whatever it was, I did same classroom where I'd met Jester. I gave a talk and I said, "Hey, look at the Segway. I bet you what they're really going." And I thought that Segway was going to go build something like this within a year or two. I thought this was really the direction they're going, because I'm like, this seems like the self-balancing sort of upright kind of thing seems like would be the really cool application, because then I can go drive in traffic, you know, because otherwise, you know, things design motorized vehicles optimized for sidewalks. You know, we're still, you know, the judgment's still out on that. But
I mean, I think not only is it a good idea, but certainly if you're looking at like where this technology is going for like accessibility and stuff like that, like that's
that's huge. Like no matter, no matter what we think about anybody who needs a moving chair, the idea of where we can go with wheelchairs or motorized scooters and stuff like that, like that's life changing. I mean, if you could have something that books like that and then is as robust and can get over things without hesitation, like, and can balance you to the point where it's as safe as it could possibly be, like, that's you know, a different lifestyle for folks who don't have the same mobility.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The concept that they show here is a full seat, you know, a full first class, you know, airliner seat. But I bet, you know, again, you like can miniaturize this stuff. You can put like stair stepper wheels on this. Like this could be like a really powerful wheelchair alternative or a new advancement in wheelchair technology.
Just rethinking that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And making it look cool as hell. Like that's that even, you know, it's like one half of a joke, but also I think for accessibility reasons, like, if you could look cool as hell in an awesome new situation like this, like that's, I think that mentally is a great idea.
And they actually have their own electric scooters that are robotic and they will return to the charging station by themselves. And they have like a pedestrian collision. So check out the Segway site, SEGWAY, to see some of the stuff they're working on.
This is the video. Kick Scooter T60 from SegwayRobotics.com. Semi-autopilot, Segway Cloud. So it looks like a three, it looks like a three-wheeled Segway.
Yeah, two wheels in the front, and then it says it's driving itself because it's got a low battery, and we watch it pull up to its own charging station to charge.
Oh, so like it's like a little outdoor parking spot with chargers in the ground. That's interesting.
Yeah. So kind of cool, like, yeah, imagine these scooters driving themselves down the sidewalk with collision avoidance and stuff. Very weird future.
Yeah.
Yep. Gentlemen, we got picks?
Yeah, I got a pick.
What's your pick?
I watched this show that nobody's ever heard of or talked about, Ted Lasso, and I was charmed by it. It is a charming program. It reminded me a lot of our friend Brett Rounceville, because he, of all the people that I know, I think the only person that would randomly go to England and try to coach a premiership team, would be Brett. Although oddly enough, the personality of his assistant coach is also the personality of Brett's wife, which kind of complicates my metaphor a little bit, but, I've enjoyed it, very much. A very smartly written show. And I've liked it. I've liked the good-hearted nature of it.
Radical Woody in our chat says Ted Lasso is everything I wanted Space Force to be. I definitely finished watching the first episode of Ted Lasso, and I watched all of Space Force season one that came out, and thought this is like the next, like this is someone developing a workplace comedy show that works. This is the next one that works. And you look at Space Force trying to do that, and Space Force not really figuring it out. I think it's so great, and it's like unabashedly positive, and it's just swell, and it's just sweet. I really dig it. I will say, like, I, you know, I'm kind of cynical, and I'm waiting for a shoe to drop on Ted. I'm still waiting for a shoe to drop, but maybe. Maybe it'll keep.
How far are you in, or are you caught up?
No, I'm not caught up. I think I'm four episodes in. I just watched the gala episode.
Yeah, from that point, you get a little bit more of the complication of the Ted character. But even in the complication, the North Star of positivity and goodness is kind of retained. It's just smart. It's a smartly written show that isn't trying to reinvent the wheel. You know where it's going from pretty much the first frame of it. You can look at the poster and kind of guess what happens when the plucky over his head American coach comes into the cynical world of British football. But at the same time, the point isn't what is going to happen. The point is how it happens, and the cast is charming. The writing is really, really competent and efficient, and
Cheers to Apple. This is the first time that I think, you know, a television show has really kind of resonated like Ted Lasso has for Apple. So cheers to them for getting this right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll say he goes through stuff and not everything's being in the presence of Ted Lasso isn't always, you know, great, so to speak, okay, kind of thing. Like there's more. Yeah. It gets more complicated, but it is a cozy show. It's a show to make you feel good. And that's one of the things often you'll see in shows that like Parks and Rec is like a perfect kind of show because there are going to be adversity, it's going to be stuff, but you're always going to want to be there and be part of that community and feel good because it's escapism. Shows, I've seen sitcoms where they go, well, we want to go deal with this subject, and that's when they become less fun because it's like, no, I like this because I'm stressed out and I just want a warm blanket, not like, what about this thing in the world we've got to deal with? And it's like, and that's the showrunners, I think, often forget that. You know, they feel like, but I want to deal with the big things.
I think that's there are shows where the plot understands why we want to be there, right? And it's you know, sometimes I think there's a tendency with shows to be like, oh no, the driving force of the plot is going to be that like we're removing the reason why you're having fun. Like, I wonder if we'll remove the reason why you're having fun. It's like either no, you're not, or B, if you do, you're gonna ruin the show. So this is just, I'm not even enjoying this conflict, and that's the fun part. There is a little Hudsucker Proxy kind of element of Ted Lasso, but that's not the point. That's not why you're there. Those aren't the things that you're dealing with repeatedly, and that's what makes it super fun.
Yeah. Also, Bill Lawrence created. I did not realize it. Co-creator of Scrubs. Is behind Ted Lasso.
Yeah, Scrubs, Clone High, Cougar Town, that dude knows how to make quick, snappy, sitcom-y television.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And the problem, I go back to Space Force, is it didn't know what it was. It was like, we got a premise that sells itself. Like, maybe consistent characters. And it was interesting to watch, you know, out the other producer of that, you know, did Upload, which I thought was fantastic, and the characters are consistent. I understood the rules of the universe and I enjoyed it. Where Space Force is one moment he's the dumbest guy in the world, the other moment he's super smart helping his daughter with homework and stuff. And I'm like, I don't know what the rules are here. I don't know what this universe means. So I don't know if something's important or not. And that's when jokes just started not kind of landing because it was such a, and we'll see, you know, if they do a season two of Space Force, because Parks and Rec had a lot of her character in season one was an idiot. In season two, an idiot obsessed with some dude. In season two, they're like, those are the least interesting things about her. Let's not make her dumb and let's ease that character out and make her more complicated. And it became a great show.
Yeah. I've got a pick. I won't say on the bandwagon, but I have definitely seen what everyone's talking about with a new little video game out there called Among Us. Have you guys heard about this?
Oh, Ashley is obsessed about Among Us. She just keeps calling me sus.
So Among Us is like a what is a good way to describe it? It's
social deduction. It's social deduction. Okay. Yeah.
It's like Werewolf. If you played Werewolf or Avalon,
Secret Hitler. Like all those games where you're trying to find out there are good guys and bad guys and activities are happening and you are deciding whether or not people are screwing up or if they are actively trying to sabotage, and then you are deciding amongst yourselves whether or not to eliminate certain people round by round, right?
It's a really interesting story in of itself, because this game came out in 2018 and it is just now blowing up as this big thing.
I didn't know that.
It's free to play on mobile with ads. It's $5 on desktop to play. The premium version on mobile is like $2 or $3. There's crossplay between all of that stuff, and I think Inner Sloth, the company that makes this, even just announced this past week, like, hey, we were going to work on Among Us 2, but we're just, instead, we're going to keep updating Among Us, this game.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't play a lot of online games. You know, there are not too many games where I'm like, oh yeah, I really want to go and interact with other gamers. That sounds cool and like a good time, and I'm going to be good at those games. Of course, I love playing Call of Duty. This one was one where like I played a few times with friends on other like Discord servers, and I actually went and found myself occasionally going in and just playing in random lobbies because this is a lot of text based chat. And it's very kind of specific about, you know, when you should and can't talk to people, right? So a lot of people who stream this game, if you're playing with that person, you cannot watch their stream because you're going to know if they're a good guy or a bad guy. But you're also, you don't even do voice chat while it's like even a big shh sign comes on right when you start the game because there's no talking while you're playing until there's like a big meeting. So it's interesting. I think they've done a good job of like of reinterpreting, you know, a pretty standard type of genre with these kind of deduction or trader games, making it really simple. You know, making it like you're the trader and you either got to kill everybody or, you know, what is it, sabotage them, or you're the good guys and you got to do your tasks or find the traitor. So it's really cool. I am like really digging it. Among Us.
I think what's fascinating about it is you take the social deduction concept and then you just add menial video game kind of tasks to it, where it's like, all right, well, you have to fix the thing. And so instead of in a board game version of it, you're like, oh, you didn't fix the thing because you've made a decision to not fix the thing because maybe you don't have the cards in your hand or something like that. And you can say, I didn't have the cards in my hand, when really you do and you're lying. In Among Us, there is the idea of like, oh no, the thing went off too late and I couldn't make my way there. And so like, that's obviously why. So there is a little bit more randomness that you can add to it that I think heightens the idea of like, okay, are you competent at this or are you sus?
It's one of those multiplayer games that has tapped into an interesting paradigm that not a lot of other online multiplayer games do, which is like, if you ever play Watch Dogs or Watch Dogs 2, those are like contemporary hacker games. And so you're going around and you hack the planet, whatever. And those are like online hide and seek.
On a Gibson, man.
Where people can just invade your game and they will show up as an NPC in your game and they have to blend in and steal all your data. And when you're getting stolen from, you have to, you know, go and find this person. When you're the person, you have to kind of blend in. There are not a lot of games that have you pretend to be another entity, either another NPC or another player. I think that's really interesting because in this one, you have to follow human behavior. Okay, well, these are the tasks that people normally have to do. So I have to go here and I have to stand here and I have to pretend like I'm doing a thing. But I can't pretend to do it at this one because when you do it at this one, the bar shows up. And so if you walk away and the bar doesn't move, then people know that you're it. Like there's what's the other game? Spy Party does that a lot, where you have to pretend to be like an AI in a dinner party and someone is a sniper. There are not a lot of examples of games doing that sort of disguising, and I think it taps into something really cool like this. So
Among Us. I love it.
Yeah, it's great. Andrew?
My pick is, and I enjoyed this. I didn't think I would. I'm not normally a cartoon guy, although between Rick and Morty and Lower Decks, that's changing. Camp Cretaceous.
Camp Cretaceous?
Any of you watch this?
I have not.
Yes, no. Jurassic Park Camp Cretaceous. It is a Netflix series, animated series, and it takes place at the same time frame as Jurassic World, and it involves a group of five kids who get invited to Camp Cretaceous because, you see, on the same island as Jurassic World, they actually were building a summer camp for kids where you could go spend a week with the dinosaurs. And these were the first kids that get to be part of the testing of Camp Cretaceous. And then Abdominus Rex gets loose. And it's the same time period as the movie. And so these kids are at the worst summer camp ever and basically have to try to survive survive the dinosaurs and their own teen dynamics.
That's a great concept. That's such a great IP for a cartoon.
And it's fun. They went to Spielberg and said, what advice? And he said, don't hold back. Don't hold back. So people get eaten. There are people getting eaten, you know, not bloody, but like, you know, the kids will watch, you know, the T-Rex chase somebody down, or, you know, Carnotaur chase somebody down. And then you see their reactions as they watch somebody getting devoured. And so like the stakes are, you can get eaten and you get to see another side of Jurassic World, because I just went and watched the movie again last night because I had fun with that. It's not, I am a big Michael Crichton fan. The book and the movie, the original movie, will always have a special place in my heart, and particularly the book, because of the complexities and everything else like this. But I also love to watch dinosaurs eating people, and I love theme parks. You put those two things together. Yeah. So here you get to see, like, they show what's it like to do a zip line over parts of Jurassic Park. You know, what's it like, you know, the monorail, like more from point of view of the monorail stuff, the Mosasaur, all these other sort of things that we saw, the Jurassic Park, the river canoe ride. What is that? And so just to see that part of the world built out by itself is cool. Then to put a bunch of teenagers in peril, fun. Yeah. So it's just fun.
How does it fit in a series format? Like in an episodic, does that feel like it makes sense compared to like the films, I guess?
It takes place over the span of a couple days.
Okay.
Okay. So like I said, of like basically in the background, you're hearing events from Jurassic World take place. Like what's the, you know, Claire or whatever, the Bryce Dallas Howard's character, the, you know, the people on are trying to get a hold of her on the radio, and you hear radio chatter that was in the movie of stuff going on. And so that takes place there. So it's roughly the same time span as it maybe starts like a day or two before like Jurassic World. So it takes place the same span there. And then as far as what the next season would be, I'm not going to say, but, It does it really well. It fits into the universe quite well, and as far as I know, it's canonical. So, yeah, it's just fun. I mean, it's not like, it's just like I said, I enjoyed it. They're 22-minute episodes. They kind of have cliffhanger stuff, and I would say that it is a much more entertaining than the second half of Fallen Kingdom, which, you know, all of a sudden we put dinosaurs in Luigi's Mansion, and it's like, what's going on?
Very cool. Jurassic World Camp Cretaceous.
On Netflix. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.